Good afternoon. Welcome to the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold. Great to be with you. Thanks to Alex for getting me going here, huh? Doyle's running behind. Alex is filling in capably, and we are off and running with another edition of the New Capital Show. Wow, what was that interesting, odd stuff falling from the sky maybe 30 minutes ago? Very strange extraterrestrial phenomena. Somebody said it's something called rain. Rain. I don't know this thing, rain. But it was pleasant. I hope we'll have more of it. 713-526-5738. Doyle is now seated, and now we're really ready to go. Thanks to Generation for doing such a great job, as always. It's such a pleasure to follow one of the station's great, great radio shows, music shows. Amazing. The stuff that they play, you won't hear anywhere else. And I want to thank everybody for contributing to the station during our pledge drive. You won't see that kind of response anywhere else either, except here at KPFT. I've got just a ton of news articles that have been building up for like weeks and weeks, and I think I'm just going to kind of download a bunch of them to get some talking points going, just to give you some idea of where I'm going. I'm going to talk about a man named Wesley Brown. I'm going to talk about golf courses. I'm going to talk about New York City banning soda bottles, big ones. I'm going to talk about a Fox News news item that closely resembles an anti-Obama political ad. Going to talk about Spain and wind power. Going to talk about United Air here in Houston cutting 1,300 jobs, announcing today. Do you see this? You saw it, Doyle? They're going to cut 1,300 jobs because their competitor, Southwest Air, got the right, voted in by city council, to open an international air terminal at Hobby.
Yeah, I heard about that.
And United, what used to be known as Continental in these parts, which of course moved its headquarters to Chicago, has chosen to respond by announcing they're going to cut 1,300 more jobs here. Yeah, let them go, United. Going to talk about coal exports out of Seattle and the Big Sandy coal plant. I don't know if we're going to have enough time for all this stuff. And, of course, the drug war, as always. Going to talk about that and a little bit of prohibition. I don't know if we're going to have time to get to all those before we get to your calls, because I do want to take your calls. Because we've had pledge drive, and I'm sure there's, as there usually is, a lot of pent-up demand to get on the air. Let's start with Wesley Brown. This is an obituary. I didn't used to read the obituaries. When I say the obituaries, I mean the New York Times obituaries. But I've started to, I guess as I get older, I guess it's a getting older thing. You start to read the obituaries. And wonder, you start to see people whose names you really recognize because they're contemporaries, people like Adam Yauch of the Beastie Boys, who recently passed. Maybe you'll pull something up for a music break by
sure.
By the Beasties.
Love to.
Maybe Sabotage?
Sure.
Yeah, they were great. He was great, Adam Yauch was. Anyway, so I read the obituaries a lot more than I used to. It's not a daily thing, but I like to see who's passing. And this is one I saw. Wesley Brown, pioneer as black naval graduate, dies at 85. 85 years old. Wesley A. Brown, a retired Navy lieutenant. And this is May 24th, about a week ago. He was a retired Navy lieutenant commander who endured intense racial hazing to become the first black graduate of the United States Naval Academy at Annapolis. The first graduate of Annapolis. He died Tuesday, a week and a half ago, in Silver Spring, Maryland, at 85 years old. The cause was cancer. He entered the academy in 1945, and he graduated in 1949. He was the sixth black man admitted in the 100-year history of the Annapolis Military College, but the first to withstand the kind of hazing that had forced the others to leave within a year, according to Navy historians. So all of the other five who preceded him, black men who attended Annapolis, were forced to leave within a year. Wesley Brown made it to graduation. White midshipmen refused to sit next to Mr. Brown. Racial epithets were whispered behind his back, and fellow plebes barred him from joining the choir. All of it mixed with and hidden behind a torrent of regular hazing that underclassmen were expected to bear. He told interviewers that not a day passed when he did not consider quitting. But unlike his predecessors, he said, Mr. Brown had the support of a handful of fellow midshipmen who were friendly to him despite receiving threats from hostile classmates and from the academy commandant who intervened to protect him from excessive harassment. Mr. Brown told an interviewer, if not for that, I'm not sure I would have made it. One midshipman who visited his dorm room to talk and encouraged him to hang in there, Mr. Brown said, was Jimmy Carter, the future president, who was then an upperclassman and fellow member of the Academy's cross-country team. In a speech last year at a Naval Academy event, Mr. Carter recalled Midshipman Brown as part of, quote, my first personal experience with total integration. Jimmy Carter's first personal experience with what he is calling total integration was a single black midshipman trying to hang in there at Annapolis. Mr. Carter said, a few members of my senior class attempted to find ways to give him demerits so that he would be discharged. But Mr. Brown's good performance prevailed. I know there is a lot of doom and gloom out there right now as someone who watches financial markets. Christ, I mean, I'm looking at them at 3 in the morning these days. And I know that people are highly concerned about the fate of the world, and they should be. But when I read an obituary like this, a life like this, Wesley Brown, the first black naval graduate in 1949, he graduated. And when I see that he was personally helped along, personally comforted and personally encouraged by a man who came from the South, the Deep South, and would ultimately serve as the President of the United States in the 1970s, I say we're making progress. We are making progress. And I truly believe that we are making progress. Let's look at this interesting article. This is, with golf courses closing because of failed real estate developments, a South Carolina club is an example of a new working model in the industry. I've talked, you know, during the boom years, I frequently talked about golf courses and the whole golf crazy thing, the building of golf courses willy-nilly and what a bad investment that was going to turn out to be. What a ridiculous allocation of capital that was going to turn out to be. So the title of this article, again from New York Times, club members learn to swing more than the 5-iron. And there's a picture of a bunch of guys with chainsaws and loppers and shovels. They're having to do their own maintenance on this golf club. in Chapin, South Carolina, slinging a pickaxe under a blazing sun as he dug a hole behind the ninth green at the Timberlake Country Club. 68-year-old Michael Kletter conceded that this was not the golf course retirement life he had envisioned. "No, I didn't dream of manual labor," Mr. Kletter, a transplanted New Yorker who is a member of the club, not its maintenance crew, said as he planted a 6-foot fern. But the recession changed everything. The golf course was in danger of closing. It's not a golf community without a golf course, so we had to do something. So Mr. Kletter joined about 300 other Timberlake members in a consortium that bought the financially distressed country club outside Columbia, South Carolina. But to make the arrangement work, the members did something that would have been unheard of 5 years ago. They agreed to do much of the work to operate and maintain the club. Good for them. On a recent hot weekday morning, about 35 members were on the course raking bunkers, planting grass, trimming tee boxes, weeding, digging holes for new bushes, and even brandishing chainsaws. Jim Pierce is a retired professor, and he says, "I know the old golf community culture was a life of leisure, but a lot of those golf courses are going bankrupt. Being leisurely has left people with a backyard of knee-high weeds instead of a beautiful golf course. The economic reality is that we had to protect our lifestyle and an investment, and so they're doing what needs to be done with sweat equity." No pun. Well, yeah, pun intended. The maintenance budget for the course is about $250,000. So they've decided to go and do that themselves. More information, more stories from the front line of the recession. Recession is, of course, not only an American phenomenon. Of course, it's now gone European. Bloomberg reports that Spain is ejecting its clean power industry. Not intentionally, but it's happening. Spanish renewable energy companies that once got Europe's biggest subsidies are deserting the nation after the government shut off aid, pushing project developers and equipment makers to work abroad or perish. From wind turbine maker Gamesa to solar park developer T-Solar Global, companies are locked out of their home market for new business.
What a waste of money.
Well, this is what happens when you're strapped. When you've put all your money into golf courses and vacation homes like Spain did, right? There's nothing left for a really, truly worthy project like alternative energy. These are the same suppliers that spearheaded more than $69 billion of wind and solar projects since 2004 that today supply more than 50% of Spain's power demand on the most breezy and sunny days. 50%.
Wow.
You know, I know there's a lot of concern about Spain right now, but honestly, they have an infrastructure in place there that I think is pretty enviable. 50% of their energy is from renewable power because of the huge investments that the country made. But they are saddled with a budget deficit, more than twice the European Union limit, and a ballooning gap between income and costs in its power system. Spain halted subsidies for new renewable energy projects in January. The bottom line here is it's just they don't have the money, right?
So it's not possible for them to exist without the subsidies?
Yeah, I mean, the subsidies have been crucial to getting the power systems, the alternative power systems, rolled out, no question. So Spain halted the subsidies in January. It was a surprise move by Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy. I don't know if I'm saying that right. It might be Rajoy. 1 month after taking office. And it helped pierce investor confidence in stable aid for clean energy across Europe. You know, this is what happens when austerity comes into place, right?
Did it mention where they were going to be exported to?
Well, the article goes on to talk about these companies saying, we're going to go somewhere else. We've got all this expertise. in supply and inventories. We're going to go take our wind turbines and solar panels somewhere else. The European Wind Energy Association chief executive officer, his name is Christian Kajar, said in an interview, they destroyed the Spanish market overnight with the moratorium. The wider implication of this is that if Spanish politicians can do that, probably most European politicians can do that. Spain's $69 billion of investment in power capacity from 2004 to 2011 was about triple the spending per capita in the U.S. Most of the 2012 to 2013 spending will be for the legacy of projects approved before the aid cuts to wind, solar, biomass, and cogeneration. This is one of the things that Paul Krugman warns against, right? Paul Krugman says this is not the time for governments to be pulling the plug on projects that are good projects, and I agree with that. You know, we were all too willing through the private sector to finance vacation homes and golf courses that are now going bankrupt.
Wow.
And so you had government subsidies going in and building something that's actually worthwhile. An entire clean energy grid in Spain that on a sunny and breezy day, and I don't know how often that happens, but I think it's pretty sunny in Spain regularly. I think it's a sunny place.
I think it's breezy, too.
Breezy and sunny.
Yeah.
50% of their power can be supplied by the systems that they put in. And in 1 month, the new president came in and yanked all subsidies overnight. Didn't phase out the subsidies. Didn't say we're going to be phasing them out over a five-year period. Just absolutely yanked any assistance for this industry. And people want to know why markets are having trouble in Spain. Well, I believe in markets. I think markets want to see success stories. I think people are getting tired of the gloom and the doom. They want to see solar power systems and wind power systems rolling out in Spain and elsewhere in the world. Spain is the world's fourth biggest wind energy market. It ties the U.S. for fourth. The population is what, one-seventh?
It's like
an eighth?
Yeah, it's like a state.
One-eighth or something, one-sixth of the U.S., like 50 million people. We're 300-something million, one-sixth. And yet it has the same size wind and solar market as the U.S. The nation installed at least a gigawatt of wind power capacity every year since 2001. And it peaked at 3.5 gigawatts in 2007. And now there's not a single project planned for 2013. So we'll see. Frankly, folks, they're going to get a lot more out of the energy systems than they're going to get out of the vacation homes and the golf courses in Spain. And again, that comment of mine goes to the idea that it all depends on the project that you're undertaking. If our systems are not geared to do projects that are worthwhile, that have high returns, that's where we're going to have problems. That's where we're going to have problems. More on energy. This is interesting. Seattle. You may know that the coal industry is having problems now. The coal industry is having problems because natural gas has become very cheap. And coal-fired power plants, and gosh, have I talked about coal-fired power plants. I think it's like the first thing I ever talked about on New Capital Show and continue to talk about. Coal-fired power plants are shutting down. It's also being helped along by the fact that the EPA has released new regulations that say that if you're going to build a new coal-fired power plant, if you're going to do that, you're going to have to put in place carbon sequestration. The CO2 is going to have to be sequestered, and that is expensive to do. You know, I don't know, $1 billion to do that to a factory. It's very expensive. So Seattle this week made a decision because what's happening to all the coal in Wyoming, right? It comes out of the Powder River Basin. And if it's not able to be shipped in the future to coal plants in the U.S. because they're shutting down, then the coal companies are determined to ship it where? You know, China. India. Well, to ship it there, they've got to ship it through West Coast ports.
I'm looking at pictures of the coal mines in Wyoming.
Oh, yeah.
Alarming.
Yeah.
You've never seen anything like
that. Total destruction of the landscape. Total.
It's a serious just pit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's total destruction. Seattle challenges coal export plan. So what is the idea here? The city of Seattle, in a 9-0 unanimous vote, the city council announces that it is the latest Northwest city to challenge the export of U.S. coal to Asia. City council declared its opposition to moving coal through the city. The city of Seattle reads text of resolution 31379. Again, a unanimous 9-0 vote. City of Seattle opposes the establishment of coal export terminals in Washington State. It lacks the power of law. The resolution is just a resolution. You know, somebody could theoretically, I guess, start a terminal and sue for the right to do it with their own property. But the city of Seattle expresses in a 9-0 vote, they don't want coal passing through Seattle and on its way to on its way to Asia. Lots going on in the coal area. Rather amazing that we are where we are. And again, brought on by cheap natural gas. So, you know, we progressives need to understand that there's fracking, but fracking is also having an effect where I think it's having a beneficial effect, which is making coal uncompetitive. AEP announces that it is backing down on a coal plant retrofit. The American Electric Power Company conceded defeat on Wednesday, just yesterday, at least temporarily in its push to save Big Sandy, its 49-year-old coal-burning plant in eastern Kentucky. The announcement surprised state officials there by withdrawing its $1 billion plan to retrofit the power plant so that it can meet tough new federal environmental regulations. What's going on there is AEP, American Electric Power, which is the largest, I think it's the largest producer of power in the country, and probably the largest producer of coal power in the country. A lot of its power goes to the East Coast. Power plants in the Midwest, you know, when you think acid rain, think AEP. But at any rate, AEP has run the numbers, and they have to choose between upgrading this coal plant. And the regulations now from EPA are such that if they decide they're going to upgrade it, they're going to make changes to it, they got to go whole hog. They can't just do a little bit. They got to do a lot. They got to retrofit the whole thing. So that means that it's going to cost them $1 billion. And so they look at it and they see that they can go ahead and maybe make a new natural gas-fired power plant for less. And then they don't have the threat of regulation and so on and so forth. Well, what's going on in West Virginia? Of course, they're going crazy, right? The people who work in the coal mines, and we have to be sympathetic. They need jobs. Everybody needs jobs. But my gosh. This is a population that has destroyed its own landscape. West Virginia, one of the most beautiful places in the country, when it was allowed to be that way. So many people have worked in those coal mines, and they now do mountaintop removal. And what is that? What? Marla's offering me something. What?
She's going to get you some water.
She's going to give me some water. Yeah, that's right. I need some water and tea. I've got a little cough. It's true. So AEP has decided to shut this down. Everybody in West Virginia, not everybody, but many people in the coal industry there, of course, are angry about this. They don't want to shut down a coal-fired power plant. They want to be able to mine for coal in West Virginia. But it's becoming increasingly clear that coal, at least at current natural gas prices, is simply not competitive. I support this. I think that coal is is incredibly destructive to the environment to mine. It's destructive to burn. And finally, it's destructive to dispose of the waste. Right? There are these big pits of coal ash. So, I mean, every single step of the process, coal causes problems. And one of the most dramatic things, I was talking at the top of the show about improvement. I told you the story about Wesley Brown and the progress that we've made and coming from such a long way in racial integration. And here we see another great thing that's going on. I could not have imagined this would happen 10 years ago when I started doing New Capital Show. And yet here we stand at the brink of a wholesale change in power generation in the United States. Lots and lots of good things going on. Maybe we'll do one more news item. I know I'm throwing out a lot, and then we'll take a break. We're almost at half past the hour. And take your calls. The number, if you want to get in and talk about any of these items, 713-526-5738, 526-KPFT. This is out today. New York plans to ban the sale of big sizes of sugary drinks. Amazing. Can they do that? Can they ban big gulps? Can a city ban big gulps from being sold? I guess if you're Michael Bloomberg, you can do anything you want. You got that kind of cash. New York City.
I bet he gets free refills wherever he goes.
Yeah. Right, then they got to ban the free refill. You know what's going to happen. Everyone's going to just get the small drink and go for the free refills. New York City plans to enact a far-reaching ban on the sale of large sodas and other sugary drinks at restaurants, movie theaters, and street carts in the most ambitious effort yet by the Bloomberg administration to combat rising obesity. Doyle, can you bring me one of those donuts out of the lobby? I'm kidding. Thank you. Water and coffee or tea?
Chai.
Oh, chai. Great. Marlo, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All right, everybody. I'm going to take a sip of something here. The proposed ban would affect virtually the entire menu of popular sugary drinks found in delis, fast food franchises, and even sports arenas. From energy drinks to pre-sweetened iced tea. Wow, pre-sweetened iced tea. And energy drinks, Gatorade. The sale of any cup or bottle of sweetened drink larger than 16 fluid ounces. Rush Limbaugh's got to be going crazy about this. Absolutely nuts.
Well, you know, sugar is just coursing in his veins, so I'm sure he stays hopped up on a slew of medications.
They have got to be talking about Mayor Bloomberg and the nanny state. This has got, I'm sure there are a lot of listeners to KPFT, a lot of Ron Paul supporters who think this is insane. But listen, folks, I'm not in favor of a ban. Rather than banning it, they ought to just tax it. Right? I don't agree with Bloomberg on this. I agree we should be targeting these things for obsolescence. Big gulps and stuff, marketing to kids. We have a diabetes problem. We've got an obesity problem. But I mean, you know, sort of like more power to Michael Bloomberg. He's not messing around there. So I don't know. What do they have to do to ban it? I'm reading through here. Is it something city council has to pass anyway? In New York City, more than half of adults are obese or overweight. Dr. Thomas Farley, the health commissioner, blames sweetened drinks for up to half of the increase. About a third of New Yorkers drink one or more sugary drinks a day. The ban would not apply to drinks with fewer than 25 calories per 8-ounce serving, like zero-calorie vitamin waters and unsweetened iced teas, as well as diet sodas. Restaurants, delis, movie theater, and ballpark concessions would all be affected because they're regulated by the health department. So I guess the health department can just make the decision. I don't know.
Here's my issue. Those fake sugars that are in those diet sodas are worse for you than the sugar. And, you know, it's like a byproduct of the chemical industry.
Yeah.
So.
Well, look, folks, I'm still going to call it progress. Okay, it's better than nothing. Let's take a quick break. 713-526-5738. 526 KPFT. I've thrown out a lot of news items for you guys to chew on. You may have your own. That's fine with me, as always. This is the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold. It's great to be back on our regular programming schedule. And we will be back in just a moment. I know a lot of you are. I know a lot of you have been absolutely on tenterhooks, waiting for the verdict in the John Edwards trial. And so, let me bring you the news from about a few minutes ago. The judge has declared a mistrial after the jury was unable to reach a unanimous verdict on all but one count. And they found the former U.S. senator not guilty on that count. That's all Bloomberg is reporting right now. Now back to the real news. before we get to a few calls, United is going to cut 1,300 Houston jobs after Southwest is awarded the right to have international flights out of Hobby. The Houston City Council voted 16-1 or something like that. We have that many people on City Council? I think that was the vote. 16-1. This is national news now. Basically, Southwest, which, as you know, flies out of Hobby, wants to be able to fly to Latin America. And United, also, you know, United Continental, of course, Bush Intercontinental Airport is a huge hub for travel to Latin America through Houston. And the Houston City Council said, well, you know, let's have more of that good thing. And so the City Council backed, and the mayor backed, Mayor Parker backed, an expansion of Hobby. Southwest is going to be able, starting, I think, in 2015, to fly to Latin America. And United, which, of course, moved its Continental was when it merged with United, the headquarters of Continental moved up to Chicago. It upset a lot of people in Houston. Jeff Smysek, who's probably one of the most, I don't know, maybe one of the most disliked people in Houston for moving the headquarters to Chicago. And United were saying, if you do this, Houston, if the city of Houston awards Southwest the right to fly a competing airline to Latin America out of Houston, the other airport, Hobby, there's going to be an impact. And the impact today is that they're going to cut 1,300 Houston jobs, and they're going to hold off on a $700 million terminal project. God, so much for fair competition, huh? No, I guess it's fair. So you all will have to decide who you want to give your flying allegiance to. Fascinating, huh? Nuts. You know, I don't know why they couldn't just go, okay, well, we'll do the best we can to serve customers and have good fees, good fares, and on-time service and good baggage claim. No, we're going to punish you, Houston. We're going to fire 1,300 people. All right, that's modern corporate America, I guess. The people's representatives, the city council here, vote almost unanimously with the support of the mayor. And United says, well, we're going to fire 1,300 Houstonians as a result. Nice. Let's take Scott. Hey, Scott.
I am not obese, and this ordinance does not benefit me.
Mm-hmm.
I once got a call to support an extension of the Houston smoking ordinance, and this was really intervention telling people not to smoke and not just where they could smoke. And I said, well, I don't smoke. My parents both smoked, both quit smoking, and I don't support paternalism.
So you're not headed to New York. You don't like what the mayor did?
No.
No.
And Pee Wee Herman was a victim of the nanny state.
Uh-huh. Well, Scott, as always, it's a pleasure to have you. I missed you over the last few weeks.
Oh, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's take Chuck next on line two. Hey, Chuck, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Hello, Dwayne. As far as this United...
Wait.
Chuck. Did I call you the wrong name again?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I keep
Chuck.
Getting you two mixed up.
Chuck. Now, Dwayne is Dwayne, and Leo is Leo.
You're Leo.
Never shall the twain...
The twain be Dwayne.
Cross divide or whatever. do cellular division or anything like that.
Okay, you know, because I called the show earlier, I think I was talking to Dwayne.
Dwayne is a fine broadcaster. He really is. I've told him many times how much I enjoy his morning show.
Mm-hmm.
But he's done by 9:30 a.m., and it's 3:30 p.m., Chuck.
And it's almost Friday, so we'll get through this.
All right, so you're forgiven. Go ahead.
Thank you. As far as this Continental, you know, or United Airlines firing these Houston employees, I'm sure the new terminal and how many people it's going to hire can absorb those jobs and then some, number one.
Okay.
So I'm not really too concerned about that. Number two, United can just go to HE double hockey sticks for a couple of reasons. One, they're a terrible airline. Southwest is not. I think many of us have more horror stories from United than we could ever shake a stick at. Now, one quick little disclaimer on this topic. I know you're pressed for time, but on another topic, actually, the end of oil breakthrough turned coal into clean diesel. National Geographic News reported on this back in 2010. It's a good article to download. Go ahead and read it. It basically starts off with what the Germans were doing towards...
Yeah.
Pardon?
Yeah, Chuck, this is the so-called Fischer-Tropsch method that the Germans invented in the 1920s because the Germans didn't have oil, but they had coal in the Ruhr Valley, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It can be done, but my understanding is that it's pretty, you know, it's the inputs are energy intensive, and so what you get out of it is you know, you have to put more BTUs in to get some BTUs out. It's just not an efficient process.
Just like
Ethanol, yeah.
Yeah, corn-based
like
ethanol,
corn-based,
really.
Like corn-based ethanol, right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I could be wrong about that. Some experts in Fischer-Tropsch might want to give a call, but that's my understanding. I mean, anytime you have to take something like a big lump of coal and turn it into oil, it's basically the same thing that's going on with the tar sands in Canada, where it takes huge amounts of water and huge amounts of energy input to convert it into something that's usable by modern automobiles.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, it's something that you would only do, as the Germans did, if you're fighting a war and you've got no other choice. You've got to fill your tanks. And I don't mean gas tanks. I mean, you know, war tanks. You've got to fill your war tanks with something.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see it.
Well, it can work if we continue to invest in the technology to improve the technology, both on the user end of the car.
They've been promising this, Chuck, for decades. You know, there was something called Syntrolium, a company, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago, and, you know, everybody was talking about Syntrolium at the time when we had higher oil prices that was a company that, you know, you never heard from them again. So I don't know. Maybe. Thanks for the call, Chuck. Great to have you. 713-526-5738. You know, on United Airlines, it just strikes me as kind of just not very good manners to the day after this, rather than just saying, you know what, we're going to do our best to keep these jobs. We're not happy with the decision by the Houston City Council. We recognize it's going to mean more competition for us. We want to continue to earn the flying public's trust and think that we will. And we're going to do our best to keep our plans for the terminal in place. We'll keep everybody up to date as we go forward. We're going to do everything we can to undertake a review. You know, we understand that the City Council expressed almost a unanimous vote of approval. I mean, that to me, that's what you would want to say, rather than we're going to fire 1,300 people. But, you know, I don't run that airline.
So you wanted a little lip service. Is that what you're saying? Yeah, that would have been nice, though.
No, I would not have wanted them to say anything but the truth, and I would have wanted what I said to be the truth. But, you know, I guess we got the truth, which is they're going to fire 1,300 people in a revenge firing against the Houston City Council. And as you know, I'm no big fan of the Houston City Council, given its absolute dereliction of duty on the issue of recycling, and the mayor's as well. You know, it's not like I'm a big fan of our city council. But, you know, I think they made the right decision here. Let's go to Tag on line three. Tag, welcome. Go ahead.
Leo, I just got to say hats off to Colonel Shaggy for his fundraising efforts. I thought he did real good on the air.
Wasn't he great?
I think that he's definitely a shoe-in for that position. You know,
he won't let me call him Colonel Shaggy, so I don't.
Oh, yeah, he's not Shaggy anymore, is he?
No, he looks quite clean-cut and handsome.
Doyle.
He'll be Colonel Clean-Cut from now on.
All right. Thanks, Tag.
Go ahead, Tag.
You know, the United thing, I think it's a certain amount of fluff because, you know, they've been talking about cutting jobs at Continental for a long time, and then they got caught up in this thing. So, you know, I don't really see this as being any more than just that fluff, you know. And but, you know, I had a comment about your Spain article, which I thought was pretty interesting. You know, the common markets really pushing austerity.
Yeah.
And look what they're doing in Greece. And Spain's in the same position, maybe not quite as bad. But so the new president comes in and he says, well, this is what we're going to do to you know, appease Merkel and the Germans is just to start cutting stuff. And that's one of them. So who's that benefit? It benefits the oil companies. It benefits the nuclear power people. And it benefits coal people, yeah. which are the ones who are really calling the shots here in our world right now, I think. So, you know, I would hope you could address that for a minute. And
okay, Tag.
I'll let you and clean cut Shaggy go.
Thanks for the call. what's happened in the world, in the United States, in Europe, and elsewhere, is we've had a big credit boom over the last decades. We've had a huge increase in the amount of debt. And as a result, rather not as a result, but one of the results, has been that a lot of that debt was misinvested. Absolutely put into just boneheaded projects. And now people are getting a little clearer. We're not there yet. We've still got a lot of people who are delusional about what a good project is and isn't. You know, a lot of people who want to build more professional sports stadiums or more golf courses, or they want to widen 20 lane freeways to become 40 lane freeways, or they want to, you know, build industrial chemical farming concerns. You know, there's still lots of delusion about what a good project is and is not, but a lot of us are coming to an understanding of what a good project looks like. High return. It provides jobs. It provides clean energy. It provides clean living. It provides clean food. It provides clean minds, if it's in the case of education. Right? We're starting to get ourselves healthy and heal ourselves after decades of just nutty behavior. People are starting to wake up to this insane prohibition that we have on very, very low grade narcotics, things like marijuana, that where we've launched worldwide military offensives to ban it. If you remember and you think back to the 1920s, remember that alcohol prohibition began around when, 1918 or so? I can't remember when the amendment was passed, but I want to say around 1918. And it lasted through the boom years of the 1920s. And then we got the Great Depression, beginning with the crash in October 1929. And then the 21st Amendment repealed the, 18th Amendment, maybe, I think is how it went, around 1933, 1934. And in the years before, we thought we were in a boom, right? We thought we were in a boom. The parallels with the 1920s and 30s that Paul Krugman really often draws, I think, are absolutely apt, especially when you look at prohibition and the marijuana prohibition we have going on now. Is very similar to the prohibition that was going on in the 1920s, right? It involved, at that time, large military expenditures, and at that time it was really crime prevention, what they call crime prevention. It involved federal agencies like the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, and the blah, blah, blah. And the same thing going on here. And so we had people living it up in the 1920s. They thought they were in a boom. They thought they were investing wisely. They built big homes. And they prohibited alcohol, and you had all sorts of crime that built up over that time. But then you had the crash in 1929, and you had 4 to 5 years of just people shell-shocked trying to figure out what to do next. And what was one of the first things that we did in 33 or 34, was we ended prohibition. Right? 34?
33. 1933. And it was 18 that it started.
Yeah, so that was the 21st Amendment? 21st Amendment ended prohibition.
Right, and it was the
1933
that started it.
And the 18th started. Mm-hmm. And and that was the same year, of course, not the same year, actually, Securities and Exchange Commission, I think it was 34. But at any rate, all these things started to happen. We did away with prohibition. You know, we stopped putting money into that crazy project. Crime went down. And what did the country go on to do? Starting in 1933, 1934, we built our greatest public works projects that the country's ever known. The Golden Gate Bridge is celebrating its 75th anniversary, like this week or something? Past week, I think the Golden Gate Bridge celebrated its 75th anniversary. It was built in 1937. The Hoover Dam, I know a lot of these projects now are anathema to those of us who are environmentalists. You know, we don't agree anymore with massive dam construction projects of rivers in the western part of the United States or anywhere in the United States. But at the time, we have to put ourselves back in the times. This country went on from prohibition and the goofiness of the 1920s and spending money on big mansions and prohibition. This country went on in 1933 and onwards to our greatest public works projects, the CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps, the building of the great lodges in our national parks, the enhancement of our national parks, the building of the great hiking trails, the dams that provided water and power to arid parts of our country, bridges like the Golden Gate Bridge, all over the country. This country went on to do some of the greatest work. And we are in exactly an analogous time period now. We have spent money on goofy, goofy things for a long time, just as they did in the 1920s. We still have the goofiness of prohibition going on. And we did a lot of this using debt financing. And so you have all the people who own the debt who don't want to write the debt down. They want the people who took out the debt to pay off the debt. And many are now saying, we're not going forward with life until these debts are covered. You know, until everyone pays off what their obligations were during this goofy period. Now, I'm not saying debt shouldn't be paid off. But I also don't think that we should be holding up the financing of projects as people come to understand that we have great projects to do. They're going to be the modern equivalent of whatever happened in the 1930s, 1933 through 19, you know, up until the war, which, you know, I hope we don't go to a war. I'd like to see the world undertake these public works projects. And I read to you the article from Bloomberg on the Spanish wind projects for a reason. You know, I wanted you to understand that unless there's support for going forward with projects, and if people decide to go into an austere economic environment, if that's what the decision is, you know, you're going to see progress stop. But just because there are outstanding debts and just because bad investments were made previously doesn't mean you don't go forward. You know what a sunk cost is? A sunk cost is when you have spent the money, it's done. There's nothing you can do. You know, you can't get your money out of the thing. It's done. And one of the first things you learn in economics is that when a cost is sunk, that's it. You've got to move on from it. You've got to go on to the next project. You've got to put it behind you. We have lots of great projects in this country and all across the world. And the United States Treasury bond is trading at 1.7% or even lower as people flock to safety, as has been going on over the past month since the elections in Greece. There are ways to finance projects. I agree. Conservatives, liberals, progressives, whatever you are, we should all agree. You know, the project needs to be a good project. And all of you listening out there, none of us, no one of us can say that we didn't get suckered in to at least some of the bad projects, whether it was golf courses or vacation homes or professional sports stadiums or additional freeway expansions beyond the point of logic or whatever. But we have good projects that we can finance in this country. 713-526-5738. We've got time. We could do another call or two. The lines are open. If you don't have anything, then I will move on to one more piece, this on the drug war. And, you know, one thing I don't understand is why we continue to wage this war on drugs. It doesn't work. It's created enormous amount of trauma and death in Mexico and other places. You know, it's really not our population that is suffering this terrible collateral damage. If you think back to Prohibition in the 1920s and you had Al Capone and gangsters and so forth, yeah, at that time you saw gang warfare here in the United States. Now the gang warfare, we've exported it, right? We keep it conveniently south of the border with Mexico. But it doesn't mean that a human toll is not being taken down there. Despite deaths in a Honduran raid, the U.S. is going to press ahead with its new anti-drug policy. Gosh, how long are we going to pursue this policy? Several villagers were killed on a Honduran river this month during a raid on drug smugglers by Honduran and American agents. A local backlash raised concerns that the United States' expanding counter-narcotics efforts in Central America might be going too far. But U.S. officials in charge of that policy see it differently. Throughout 2011, counter-narcotics officials watched their radar screens almost helplessly as more than 100 small planes flew from South America to isolated landing strips in Honduras. But this month, after establishing a new strategy emphasizing more cooperation with various U.S. U.S. departments and agencies, two smugglers' flights were intercepted in a single week, and the U.S. is going to press ahead. So, I don't know. William Brownfield is the Assistant Secretary of State for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement. He says, in the first 4 months of this year, I'd say we actually have gotten it together across the military, law enforcement, and developmental communities. My guess is narcotics traffickers are hitting the pause button for the first time in a decade. Air shipments are being intercepted immediately upon landing. We'll see. How many times have we been told that? That, you know, we're winning the war on drugs. It's crazy. You don't make war on drugs. You make war on drug addiction. Right? Right. You make war on drug addiction. And you don't make war on it. You treat it. Don't make war on drugs. Treat drug addiction. Philip is holding. We've got time for one more call. Philip, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Thank you. We're spending $1 trillion over, or even more now, over there in the wars. And, you know, yeah. Why don't we just get out? I mean, imagine if we spent that $1 trillion, and thank you, George W., for, you know, being a businessman and spending that money over there instead of here. What if we spent that money here? Imagine what we'd have, you know?
Yep.
I mean, let's place wealth. And we're looking forward to doing the same thing in the future, I think, you know. I mean, we're going to get Romney in office, you know. Oh, hey, I'm a businessman. I can do it for you guys. Mm-hmm.
Yep. No, I think so, Philip. I do think we are getting out. It is taking a while to do it, and it took a while to get out of Vietnam as well, of course, and these types of wars that we have gotten ourselves into during our lifetimes.
Business has got us into this. Why do we want to go back to business, saving grace?
But I think most people now agree in this country that it's time to spend that capital in different ways. Philip, great for your thoughts, for your call, and your opinion. Take care.
Thanks for your show. Bye.
Okay, that does it for another edition of the New Capital Show. NewCapitalShow.com, and you can Facebook me. Oh, yeah, Facebook. I don't know what the share price is today, but whatever it is.
We have to have a war on Facebook addiction.
Yeah, LeoGold.NewCapitalShow. Friend me on Facebook, and I will be back next week. Thanks to Marlo for bringing me the hot beverage to keep me going here, and to Doyle, as always, for his great engineering. Stay tuned right here. Please don't turn the dial. KPFT Local News is coming up next.
Internationally renowned protest singer David Rovics, a voice for the 99%, will perform in Houston.
Because 99% of us are suffering at the mercy of the madmen on this street. Because all of us are victims of class warfare being waged on us by the 1%. Because these greedy banksters rob the country, leaving us without the means to pay the rent.
Featured on Democracy Now! And many KPFT programs, David Rovics will share songs of social significance on Thursday, May 31st at 8 p.m. Rovics plays at the East End Studio Gallery, 708 Telephone Road, Suite C, Houston, Texas, 77023. Again, David Rovics plays Thursday, May 31st in Houston. Visit Facebook for event details and updates. This is KPFT Houston, Radio for Peace.
Listeners support KPFT in many different ways. Some write checks and others use credit cards. But if you're spinning your wheels looking for a tax deduction, think about donating your working but unwanted car, motorcycle, boat, or truck to KPFT. You'll qualify for a tax deduction and at the same time take care of that unfinished business. To make a donation, call our toll-free vehicle donation hotline at 877-308-2408. We'll arrange for your vehicle to be picked up and the title transferred. Then we'll send you a receipt for your tax deduction. It's that simple to support the station you've come to rely on for alternative music, news, and public affairs programming. Again, for more information or to make a donation, call our toll-free vehicle donation hotline at 877-308-2408. You're tuned in to commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston, Radio for Peace.
You're listening to KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM, listener-sponsored.